This podcast is brought to you by Zeno Mueller, three-time Olympian and gold medalist. The summer is upon us, so imagine a 20-second 2K PR by the fall. Elite rowing coach of Zeno Mueller is a competitive advantage. The ERG score is the SAT of rowing, so find out what Zeno Mueller can do for you. Make sure to use coupon 4STARS, F-O-R-S-T-A-R-S, for $100 off on any program he has on his website. Zeno is an Olympian and graduate from Brown University, coached by Steve Gladstone. He'll get you right, get your 2K down, and you'll be a better athlete after his training. So make sure you tune in with Zeno and get some coaching at eliterowingcoach.com.
On tonight's program, ladies and gentlemen, we have something that's going to make you sick.
In winning and learning, then there is no losing. And I really believe that.
Welcome everyone to another episode of the 4STARS podcast, where today I'm here with James Clark. He is an University of Washington alum on the rowing team and also a professor at the school as well. James Clark currently resides in Seattle, Washington. He lived in my hometown for, I think it was what, 17 years, sir? 17 years. And so now he's back home in Seattle, and I felt like it was only right to talk to him today. You know, James has had a great story in rowing. He's been a coach. He's been a mentor to many people. And the fact that he's sitting with me here today means a lot. And to be honest with you, I do have to give a shout out to my really good friend's mom, Tammy Coburn. She was able to connect me with Mr. Clark, and I had no idea that this guy lived in my hometown for so many years up until she told me about this. I was like, there's no way. So first of all, Mr. Clark, thank you so much for hopping on the 4STARS podcast. I appreciate you.
Thanks for having me.
Of course. So a little bit more about your background in the sport. I think what your story is so unique, because I haven't personally met anybody who's gone through something like what you have. And I think that for you to enlighten the audience of kind of what happened would really be impactful. Well,
briefly, 17 years old. I got hit in a head-on collision, spent basically a year in bed. I was a good pole vaulter in high school, probably a candidate to win state in Washington. And here I'm in bed, major operations. And after a year, my leg had to come off. So I lost my leg. We were welfare, no money, no leg. Looked pretty bleak. And my aunt in Murray, Kentucky had a $12 insurance policy that was enough to buy me a leg. And I begged what was called Voc Rehab at that time to give me 1 year of college. So I had a leg and I had a year of college. I rolled at the University of Washington. And as I rode the elevator up to my dorm room, shaking as a kid, I've been walking for a month on this leg. I saw a sign that said 6'2", turn out for crew. And if you're not an athlete, sign up to be a manager. And I thought, there's only really one choice on this list for me. So I became third string manager for the University of Washington rowing team. And when driving the motorboat for the head coach, one day I looked over at the third boat and I saw a kid with a brace on his leg. And I thought my heart was going to stop, because I thought that could be me. And so that night, I snuck down to the old training barge called Old Nero, found an oar, and was sort of proving to myself that I could do the stroke motion. And I smelled a cigarette, and it was the freshman crew coach at midnight. And he said, "What are you doing?" And I said, I was panicked. I said, "I'm testing the oar." And he says, "You're an effing liar." And I said, "You got me." And he said, "Stand up." So I stood up, and I could hardly see him in the dark. But he said, "I knew you were a top-notch pole vaulter in high school. And the boys on the team don't care if you try out for the team, but why don't you try out?" And I said to Dick Erickson, who became a famous coach, I said, Dick, do you think I can make the team? And he said, no, I think you'll get cut. And I thought, this is the worst thing anybody could ever say to me. You know, try out, but I think you'll get cut. And he continued and said, listen, the boys don't care if you get cut. The coaches don't care who they cut. If they don't care, why should you care? Just turn out. And I'd never been talked to like that. And I kind of straightened up and I said, what do I need to do? And he said, get a bicycle this summer. I started school spring quarter of what would have been my freshman year. Missed the first two. And he said, get a bicycle this summer, ride 30 to 60 miles a day, and come next fall, wear a pair of sweatpants and turn out. And that's what I did. And so I made the Husky team barely. And it was a fabulous experience for me.
So how many years were you competing for UW?
Well, I rode 3 years. And I'm going to jump ahead. In the first year, I rode in the sixth boat. You can't get lower than sixth boat. And because I was an oddball in terms of when I started, they couldn't let me be on the freshman team. So I became a jock. And there were several guys in that category. So we initially trained with the freshmen, got moved up to the varsity that same quarter and fall quarter. And so I was rowing with the sixth boat in the varsity. I couldn't see what color shirt the coach was wearing. I couldn't hear a word he was saying. We were so far away at practice, but I was still glad to be there. And so 2 years later, my third year, I'm in the third varsity boat, and we're having a runoff with a JV boat to see who gets to go to Cal and race on the estuary. And I was like a little kid. It was a dream come true. And by then, I was in great shape. We all were. And long story short, we beat the JV boat two times on a 2,000-meter run. The coach was smoking cigarettes after each run. And after the second time we walloped them, we kind of figured it out. He wasn't going to take us. And I was so brokenhearted that I quit the team. And I went to the same freshman coach that invited me to try out. And I said, Dick, I was runner-up for Commodore of the rowing team. That's top dog. Of all the guys on the team, they wanted me to be in charge of the rowing program. And here I am, aced out of a seat in a racing boat. And Dick Erickson turned around to me and said, Clark, listen, when you're not in the boat, it goes faster. And it just broke my heart. It absolutely broke my heart. I thought he could have said, I'm sorry, I wish you well. But all he said to me was, when you're not in the boat, it goes faster. And so for the next month, I had the longest look on my face and felt so sorry for myself that I'd overcome so much to not get to race and get a letter for the Huskies.
So when you heard this news that they said that you weren't able to compete for them, and in a sense that you were making the boat slower, to be honest with you, most people would think that if a coach tells you that, then you do whatever you can to get faster. You put some more meters in on the erg, you get in the boat a little bit more, you figure out what you can do, build your fitness up. But for you and your situation, that really wasn't something that you could do. Am I right?
Hey, quick question for you. Are you someone who wants to be fit, healthy, and happy? And what if I told you could get your dream body by simply just listening to a podcast? I'm Josh.
And I'm KG, and we are the hosts of the Fit, Healthy, and Happy podcast.
Listen, we get it. Fitness isn't easy. Carbs, no carbs.
Just stop, okay? It doesn't have to be that complicated. And that's why we made this podcast. We get straight to the facts so you can become your best you.
So the way to check us out is click the link in the show notes or go search Fit, Healthy, and Happy podcast on any of the major podcast platforms. We'll see you soon.
Yeah. And you know, that when he said, go get a bike and ride 30, 60 miles a day, I did it all summer long. I, on the corner of our house, I did pull-ups so I could get stronger. In that third year, the head coach instituted the Canadian Air Force 5BX drills. My teammate and I, my partner rowing, had been doing those drills for a couple of years after practice. So we finished number one and two on the whole team on these Canadian Air Force drills. So I thought, I'm ready to race. And so when Dick Erickson told me that, for that next month, it was in some ways the lowest point in my whole life, even in some ways worse than losing my leg. I tried so hard to overcome adversity, and then I was slapped down. But as I was walking on campus about a month later, it hit me like a lightning bolt that the head coach, never owed me or any of the boys anything. And it was in some ways the best day of my life to that point, because it told me that I earned everything important about being a winner. Mm-hmm. I had never raced, so I didn't win, but I was a winner. We were all winners. We were getting knocked down grades. The girls were looking at us finally in our third year of college. We weren't as nerdy as we were the first couple of years. And I started thinking, son of a gun, this is more than a dream come true. And there's no racing seat that had my name on it. None. And so the coach, he did what he wanted to do. And was it fair? I don't know. But I do know that it made me stronger. And so I had never been a good student in high school, but I went on and got a PhD, became a college professor. And I think it inspired me to think that I could use grit to my advantage, which a lot of people write about grit nowadays and say it's the number one thing we need in our lives to motivate us to succeed. And I would only add a twist that if you're nimble with grit, like you are with school, there aren't many roadblocks that are going to stop you, because life isn't linear. It just isn't. And you already know that.
Yeah, of course. I think that one of the things that I really found not really inspirational, but more just like, I don't think anybody I've ever seen in my life have overcome the obstacles that you have. So in a sense, you are very inspirational, more inspirational than I've ever met. And so for me, that I think is going to inspire a lot of people, that no matter what the difficulty is, disability that you may have, you're still able to do something. And even if you get let down and if it doesn't work out the right way that you wanted it to be, you still probably inspire. I mean, you definitely inspired all those guys on that squad for many years. Yeah, you definitely did. And, you know, we see stories about kids who have disabilities or mental illnesses that aren't able to compete in sports, but they make them as managers. They make them as different things like that. And they're able to add to the team. And they honestly make the team what it is. If that athlete wasn't a part of that as a manager or whatever it is, that team wouldn't be the team that it is. So again, I have a lot of respect for you for doing that and for going out there and doing your best.
I have to tell you something that added to the coach's decision to not pick me is because amputees have a fixed ankle with their prosthesis. When I would come up the slide to do full extension, whether it's on an ergometer, which we didn't have then, or in a sweep boat, I could only come up so far before the right angle on my prosthesis hit the foot stretcher, and I couldn't come any farther. So I had to almost let go with my outside hand rowing port side. So I developed this Popeye muscle where I could hang on to initiate the drive. And same with the end of the stroke, coming back to the finish, instead of being able to point my toes and get a little bit more run, I couldn't do that. So 10 years after I graduated, my same rowing partner came to me and said, it's time to scull. And I said, I have no idea what you're talking about. He said, I've entered you in a race. He was starting a little rowing program near Renton, Washington. And long story short, he wanted me to race a candidate for heavyweight champion boxing. And his name was Boom Boom Kirkman. And I thought, what are you talking about? So he lined me up for this race. I had never been in a small, narrow racing single. And because of my leg, I thought, I just mechanically can't do this right. I can't come up full extension, and I want to be at war with Boom Boom. And it inspired me to go to somebody and make an artificial leg where the ankle could pivot. And this guy named Drew Hittenberger from California used a door hinge from Home Depot or somewhere, a $3 door hinge, and put it on an artificial foot so it could pivot. And all of a sudden, the handicap, for the most part, went away because I had my quads. I had no excuses. And so even though Boom Boom happened to beat me that day, I ended up being a sculler and sculled all over the U.S. and in Masters National sculling competitions. And there's some stories that go with that. But yeah, it didn't stop me from growing.
That's insane. I think, to be honest with you, Coach, if there was a entire bus in front of you, you were going to find a way to get either under, above, or to the side of the bus. There was no way that was going to stop you. And I think that is really inspirational as well, and teaches everybody as well in this podcast that's listening to this episode. And no matter what you're faced with, there is a way to either get around it or to overcome it. And you are a testament to that. So I applaud you.
I have to tell you something, that once I got past the insecurity of being handicapped and looking different, by the way, when on the rowing team, the first 2 years, I showered by myself after practice. I didn't want anybody to see me. I was just too insecure. And at the end of my second year of spring, I was in a two-person shower upstairs at Conibear Rowing at UW. And nobody else came there. I think they respected that I wanted to shower by myself. And I heard the shower door open. And it was one of my teammates. And I said, well, what are you doing? And he didn't say anything. And finally, I said, Kroger, what are you doing? And he says, I'm taking a shower. And I thought, he doesn't understand. This is my shower. This is my domain. So 30 seconds later, the door opens again. And a third guy comes in. And a fourth guy comes in. And Kroger turned to me and he said, stop it. Give it up. No more of this. And that pivoted me from, instead of thinking like a handicapped person, to say, this doesn't have to be a big deal. And so when I started racing and sculling races, I went the other way. I would sit at the starting line, like a Masters Nationals. And these guys look good, Cambridge Rowing Club. You know, we didn't look as good as these guys look like they belonged on, you know, GQ magazine. And so they tended to ignore us. Guys like Ibbotson that had been an Olympian, he wouldn't even see us. And I was sitting like 10 feet from starting line. So I reached down, I took my artificial leg off, and I pretended I was adjusting it. And my rowing partner in the double scull loved it, because then all the eyes were pointed at us. And I thought, it's like, what's Rodney Dangerfield? It's like we finally got respect in an odd sort of way. And we called it the look. Because the first time they would look at me as an amputee, they would say, gee, I feel sorry for that guy. He's missing his leg and he thinks he's going to compete with us as red hot rowers. And the second look was, how did they get to the finals of this competition? They didn't just get a free ticket. And the third look was, what if they're good? What if these guys are with us at the finish line? And that was the look I was wanting to see. So I had a lot of fun with it over the years. Once I got past myself, and you know, I don't know if you get a hard time from friends or family saying, why didn't you stay at this school? Why are you switching schools? Why are you doing this? What are you doing being a coxswain? Like this and that after, you know, a little bit of training. Life is so short. You know, I'm 70, almost 78 years old. And I've not only learned to have grit, and I've not only learned to be flexible, but I've also learned to not just laugh about it by myself, but with other people. And I think maybe that's the most important thing that's helped me in rowing. And I have to admit, nowadays, when I see rowing, collegiate rowing teams so bent on winning at all cost, I feel sorry for them. Because I think, what else is there? You know, you're going to recruit all these foreign athletes to be in your boat instead of growing your own American kid rowers. And I don't mean to sound political, but I think there's lots of good U.S. kids that could be top-notch rowers.
Do you know Steve Gladstone? Sure you do, right?
I know a lot about him. I haven't actually met him. I've met Mike TD and some of those guys, but
oh, okay. Yeah. So I had Steve on the podcast, and I even asked him that question. I said, you know, you all these people always ask about international athletes and how Yale is really comprised of international athletes and a little bit more than American athletes. And, you know, what's the reasoning behind that? And he told me, he goes, well, Hudson, the secret to Yale is not the international athletes. What it is that international athletes have just more time in the boats. They've been rowing since they were 10, 11 years old. They are a lot more advanced than some of our athletes that we have here in America. And some of our athletes in America as well, and I'm not going to butcher what he said, but some of our athletes in America as well are actually very, very skilled and have so much power. And we see this with, I'm not too sure if you've been following up with this, but Isaiah Harrison, he's 6'9", 225 pounds, and he's a sculler, a single sculler. And he's been competing at world championships and whatnot. And he's like, I think 5 minutes and 44 seconds, I think, on 2K, really fast. And he's, you know, he's putting in the work and he's beating out all these international athletes that have been rowing for such a long time. And so there is hope. There is a lot of hope. Clark Dean as well. I'm sure you know Clark Dean. He was a junior athlete out of Sarasota, Florida. Now he's rowing at Harvard. And he's also been killing it. So there are a lot of American athletes out there that are completely doing very well at world championship races and whatnot. But then there's a lot of times where there's international athletes that really beat out us Americans. And so what is it? Is it sculling? Is it sweeping? What is it that they have over us? And to be honest with you, I just think it's honestly the way that they train, but also not only that, how much they train throughout the day and just their experience, how long they've been doing it for. You know, we see it in America. We see a lot of people that have been competing since their junior, senior, sophomore, junior in high school, where in Europe, it's, you know, 9, 10 years old. So it's just a different, you know?
Yeah. Although your friend, Sammy.
Yes.
I gave her first set of rowing lessons in a wherry on Little Westlake. And here she's rowing in University of Texas 1V, and they're probably going to repeat as national champions. She can scull on either side of the, you know, starboard or port. So I embrace what you're saying. I think what annoys me is seeing all of the kids in the first and second boat from other countries. And my thought is, I don't understand that, because I think that part of our commitment as an educator, I taught seniors and grad students and PhD students, is to not only teach kids from all over the world, but you know, to be dedicated to teaching kids from our own country also. Mm-hmm. And so that's I'm too old to worry about this. But when we talk about boys in the boat and legacy, I think legacy is growing your own. That's what legacy means.
Yeah. I hear you. I really do hear you. I've actually, you know, they're making the movie at Boys in the Boat. You heard about that? They're making a movie about it.
George Clooney,
Yep. So I'm extremely excited to see that. My buddy and I have been wanting to see that movie ever since we were in high school. We were like, imagine if they actually made a movie about it, and they started making it right when we left high school. And so I was like, this could be awesome. So we actually, the first day it comes into theaters, we're going to be going together to the movie theater right then and see it. And I mean, I'm probably going to see it like 20 different times, but it's just, I'm so excited to see it, and it should be a lot of fun.
Me too.
I've actually never read the book, so
there's some great lines in it.
Yeah. I definitely have to go to the store and buy it and read it. That's one of my goals this summer is to start reading the book, because everyone always talks about it, and I'm here running this rowing podcast, had not ever read the book before, and it's like, Hudson, you're really slacking. You gotta start, you know, bump up the pace here. So
you're having your own good experiences, and in some ways that's even better than reading about somebody else's.
Yeah. What would you say to somebody who may be struggling with a disability? Maybe if they have similar things to what you had, what would you say to somebody who's doesn't know where to go or how to start, but they want to be a part of something bigger than themselves?
Looking in terms of physical activity or mental academic things, so much of my limitations, having been in bed for a year, was just getting over this idea I was dependent on other people. And so for me, square one was to say to myself, I've lost so much. And I think that's how a lot of physically challenged people think. I've lost so much that I don't have a comparative advantage. And so it's almost better just to go back to square zero and say, I have nothing to lose. And if I have nothing to lose, I can call anybody, I can reach out to anybody. But I think I had my high school student body president. When I was student body president before I got hurt, I would be reluctant to call somebody thinking, well, student body president is supposed to know this. But when I was a handicapped kid, I could reach out to anybody because I had nothing to lose. In a backwards sort of way, it gave me a leg up, so to speak. But in terms of physical activity, I'd say whatever muscles or bones you have that you can use, those are the ones that you can turn into a fun activity. And so when I turned out for that rowing team, I still had this engine going that I really wanted to be a college athlete. And I don't know if it was a dream or an aspiration or a goal, but I just know that it wouldn't leave me alone. And so it was embarrassing. When I showed up for tryouts that September after Dick Erickson told me, I thought I had a chance to make the team. So we went from 250 kids down to 50. And the last day when I made the final cut, I thought we were done. We're just going to go shower. And I was on the team and I could write, call home and say, I did it. I'm a handicapped guy and I achieved something. The coach said, we have one more goal to do. We're going to go up on the Husky track. We're all going to run 3 miles around the track. And I thought, I can't do that. I run like I'm a flat tire on a car. And so I did run the 3 miles because he told me, if you don't do it, what's it going to do to your relationship with the boys? Because I was trying to beg him not to have me run those 3 miles. So my lesson or advice for other mobility challenges people is dream big, focus on what you can do. So many sports have changed now, like snow skiing. I mean, it's a handicapped sport.
Right.
It's, you know, for people that are paraplegics, right. Even.
Yeah. I mean, U.S. Rowing has implemented events for people who have disabilities like that. And I think it's really cool because we see it in basketball. They have like, I'm not too sure what the name is, but they have like special events for people who play basketball to compete in because of, you know, they can't go up against people who have their full body working. You know what I'm saying? So I think it's great that rowing is accessible to people who have those disabilities. And the fact that you were able to go out there and do your best and prove to everybody, and not only prove to the people who didn't believe in you, but prove to the people who believed in you that they were right.
One thing, when I started winning in double sculls as a 30-something year old guy and continued doing it for years with the same partner, we put in a lot of miles. Well, I finally got the courage to go to the world championships. So here I am at an American eight, a mixed eight, put up a little sign saying I'm available to row with other people. I didn't tell them I was an amputee.
Wow.
And so I get calls from different people, including a guy from Budapest that had been on the SK, the famous Hungarian rowing team.
Yeah.
And he said, I'll row with you in a double scull. So I meet this guy, and now I think I have to apologize. And I said, his name was Miklos Jarmi. And I said, Miklos, I need to show you I have an artificial leg, and it's okay if we don't row together. And you know what he did? He reached down and grabbed my quad, and he says, good, good. So he didn't look at my prosthesis. He looked at my quads. Mm. He, you know, you have all the stuff we need to make a boat go fast. We didn't win, but we rode a great race. But I was ecstatic that I got to row with the Australians in a boat and some New Zealanders in a boat and some UK young men in a boat. And the worst thing I ever did was happen to be at a sculling race at Oregon State on the Willamette River. Mm-hmm. Won the sculling event against the five knot current. And as I was putting my boat away, the alumni boat from Oregon State said, our guy is stuck in traffic. Can you sub in and row? And I was wearing sweatpants. And I said, sure. And they didn't know I was an amputee. So I yanked my sweats off. I go to climb in the boat. And this guy goes, my God, look at what do we have here? So their assumption immediately was they couldn't win against in this alumni race. We raced, we won. And as we were coming back to shore, I couldn't resist. I said, I am so sorry. I never got my leg on. I actually was never able to take a stroke the whole race. And it just cracked them up, but I did. I mean, it was, you know, it was good for me and good for them. But I think, you know, I chose not to, at the time, there was no special needs events for amputees. Now there are, and I'm thankful that there are. Yeah. But hey, I want to race guys with two legs.
Yeah, I think that you were in that, correct me if I'm wrong, it seemed to me almost as if you were in that mentality that you still had two legs.
Yeah, yeah, that's right.
And that really, to be honest with you, that really, wow, speaks volumes to who you are, sir. But I did hear that you are in the midst of writing a book.
Yeah, I some of my friends said I needed to write, Sammy's parents said you should write your memoirs. And yeah. I actually didn't know what a memoir was beyond the obvious.
Yeah.
And it turns out it's difficult to write a memoir because you're only supposed to tell part of your life story, not bore people with your whole scripture and verse.
Right.
And so I am pretty much finished with the second draft. And I'm still playing with the title of it, but anyhow, probably it's going to be something like Be in the Hunt or In the Hunt, because we used to, when I coached, when I rode, I used to think that I could be a winner if I could be at the finish line close to winning. My rowing partner, who I loved dearly, loved to win. He was used to winning in his life. And so if we took second in a race he thought we could win, he was disappointed. And so one of the things I wrote about was to say, it's okay if we have different ideas, but for me, if I could be in the hunt at the finish line of life, whether it was an academe or being a student or being a spouse, that not all of us can win. I mean, in zero-sum game, one winner and five losers, what's that about? And I don't mean to be too metaphysical, but I thought it was important from an amputee perspective to say a lot of the best stuff in life is just being in the hunt at the finish line. And I was not the most revered faculty member on the faculty, but in my last year of teaching, I won the teaching award at the
Congratulations. UW. Congratulations.
Yeah, four of us, amazing. Four of us did. And I thought, son of a gun, I was not the scholar. I didn't go to London School of Economics or Wharton, but I was a good teacher. And turns out students like having good teachers.
Yeah.
And so, that's been helpful with me as a parent of four kids, as a spouse, as a coach, because I want kids to believe that they can be in the finish line of life. And winning at all costs doesn't do it for me. Mm-hmm. Even winning, I think, is overrated. And I know I'm in the minority for saying this because we want to have the highest SAT, the highest GMAT, the highest GPA. And my thought is, and then what do you got? After you get the highest GPA, then what do you got?
Right.
My thought is, if you're in the hunt, then you can work with other people to also be in the hunt. And some of the time you're going to win. And I did win plenty of races, but more times than not, I didn't win. But if I wasn't in the hunt, I needed to ask myself, did I pick the wrong race? Did I not train hard enough? Am I technique not good enough? Those are things that are all improvements. So what's that saying? If you believe in winning and learning, then there is no losing. And I really believe that.
Well, first off, let me just say, I cannot wait to read your book because it's, I already know it's going to be amazing. I might actually read your book before I even get a chance to be with the boat. So, so yeah, I want to be out there. And again, everyone listening, be on the lookout for this book. it might be titled In the Hunt. So if it is, I'll be sure to put it out on my social media as well to get it out there, because people need to listen to and read to it. And last couple things, we've all talked about kind of inspirational stuff, what you hope people to remember you as and things like that. But one of the things that sticks out to me is I had a question. You talked about, you know, your coach said that if you were on the track and you didn't run the 3 miles, that your athletes would think differently of you. Did your coxswains ever participate in like running with you guys and being a part of the team in that regard, like the physical aspect?
Absolutely. They went to the weight room. One of our better coxswains was a polio victim, and so he could do certain things in the weight room. He limped around the track. I vividly remember it. So he was kind of dragging his leg. I think we were all in it together, and we always thought the coxswain was the smartest guy in the boat. I got to row in the eighth seat most of the time. Mm-hmm. So I got to realize how valuable the coxswain was, because I might say, take it up two, and the coxswain said, not yet. And instead of us having a debate, it was always his decision.
Right. Yeah. A lot of times rowers tend to fight with the coxswain in a sense, and it just really just makes it harder. Not just the coxswain, but the boat itself. Like, you want it to just go fluid, just listen. And if something is drastically wrong and that needs to be done, then speak up. But for safety purposes and whatnot, it's just better to just listen, just kind of go with the flow. And that's also a lesson that I've been kind of thinking about my whole life, is kind of, I always try to input. If I'm on the coxswain seat, I'm always trying to give my input into things. And I'm not going to lie, sometimes it really doesn't go my way, and that's okay. I learned from that, you know. But this sport really can teach you how to be the best version of yourself. And I've talked about it so much, and I believe it, and I really do believe it. And so I just hope and can't wait for this book to come out and for people to realize what it takes to be up there, and for people to also understand that it really doesn't matter what you're going through. You can do it with the right mentality. The right mentality, you're going to get far in life. And sir, I think you've gotten really far in life, and you've inspired countless of people, and you're going to continue to inspire people. And a lot of people after this podcast might want to reach out to you and talk to you, because they might be looking for someone who's been going through something that also they have gone through as well. So I'm just going to let you know, you might get some emails. So just be on the lookout for that. But that's all I'm going to have right now, personally. I really still can't believe that you have been in my hometown for almost my whole life. Never knew that you rode. Never knew that there are people, Olympians, training in the lakes nearby our house. Had no idea. And I've been trying to figure out how to make a boat club. My rower in high school, who actually is at Oregon State right now, we were thinking about making a boat club on Lake Sherwood. And it was like, there's definitely a spot for it. We picked out a spot, but we just got to get the people to make it. And that's going to be a lot of money. But maybe we'll see if this podcast can get up there. I can get some good money into it, and we can get some investors. Maybe we can get our own little boat club. So
I agree with you.
Yeah. And again, if it does happen, we'd love to have you out. So
I'd like to come.
Yeah. So that's all I have for you today, sir. Just wanted to say thank you again. And again, you've really inspired me. You've inspired a lot of people. And just keep doing what you're doing, because you're doing a great job.
Thanks for having me.
Of course.
Sure. Yep. I didn't mention this. I would put my rowing prosthesis, my walking prosthesis, on the dock with a towel over it on the launch dock. Think of how crowded the launch dock is. I picked a little corner, put it there, put my rowing leg on, sort of got my way to the boat, climbed in the boat, raced, came back, and put my leg on. And I think for some people, they were offended to see this. It's like taking your dentures out or your glass eye, or, you know? Yeah. And but it was good for them to say, no big deal. If it's not a big deal for him. So once I got past that shower thing I mentioned to you, then I could not worry about my leg being on the dock. And then I could start wearing a pair of shorts and not worry about, you know, people seeing my leg. But I think for a 17-year-old kid that's already kind of insecure in life anyway, you know, it doesn't take much for us to be really timid about showing up. So,
right. What do you think your kids learn from you?
Well, I think they, you probably have to ask them. I think they have learned to not let roadblocks stop them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because in life, you're going to get them. Roadblocks are going to be there. They're going to get you.
Yeah.
In times where you don't think they are, and they will get you in like the worst time possible. And I believe the true power of an individual is what they can do when they're faced with an obstacle.
Yeah.
And that is something that I believe true to my heart. So,
yeah.
And you've done crazy stuff to think what you were faced with such a terrible obstacle in your life. But it, correct me if I'm wrong, sir, it really made you James Clark. It made you. Like, if, do you think that
farm boy,
yeah.
I was a farm boy from a little town. I had a B minus average, never made the honor society in high school. But I got a joint PhD and taught for 20 years. And I look back and I think sky's the limit. And I think we all have roadblocks. We all have stories to tell. They're just different stories. And therefore, we all have roadblocks. And I think adversity is such a great teacher.
Adversity is needed to be a better individual. I believe that as well. So again, you've got some great messages to, have in this podcast, and we're going to get a lot of them out there, and people are going to realize the true power of what you can do. So I'm excited. I really am excited. And again, your book, In the Hunt, hopefully, I think that's a great name for it, In the Hunt. I've never heard of a book called that before. So I would stick with that. But yeah, that's all I really have. And this is another episode of the Four Stars Podcast. I appreciate you, Mr. Clark. Mr. Clark was an alum of University of Washington. He wrote on the team there and was also part of the university as a professor. So again, thank you again, sir. Appreciate you. And we will see you soon, hopefully.
Okay. Take care. See ya.